Okay, we're going to call it to order. I apologize, I started a little bit late. We have such a huge event today to talk about that I kind of hate to bring up one little thing for me, which is I got a call from my fourth child in a meeting I was at earlier, and we all know as parents when you get a call from a child you're very worried, but my fourth child passed the driver. He got his license today, so that's a big deal. but I'm terrified of that because he's 16, and I hate a 16-year-old with a driver. But the big event today is Chair Davids has so much to tell us, and we're dying to hear all about it. So, yes. Representative Davids.
7 pounds, 3 ounces, blue eyes, 20 inches and 3/4. I'm not quite sure how you say that properly. 20 and 3/4 inches. Is that right?
Yeah, you're right. You're
20
right.
Inches plus 3/4. And in La Crosse, everybody's fine. I've got some pictures here. I'll show you later. And I got him a set of Titleist golf clubs, so we're ready to go.
Oh, yay! Oh. Now, what's his name?
His name is Samuel Gregory Larson. And so I bought him a plaque, and it says S. Gregory Larson on it. Heavy on the, yeah.
You know, if we would have thought it through, we would have figured out how to get his picture up there on the screen. Maybe you can tell us how to do that. I don't know. But anyway, congratulations. It's so exciting.
So thank you, Madam Chair.
No, it's so exciting. So we're really happy for you. So we're going to do overviews today, and I think the only thing we need to do is to approve the minutes. So if anyone's had a chance to look at them, Representative Garofalo moves the minutes, I think, because he found that we had him not here and he was here. So if that's okay, Representative Garofalo, do you move the minutes? Okay, so Representative Garofalo moves the minutes. Questions? Discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The minutes are adopted. So that's it for official business. We're just going to go through the overviews. I know everybody's really busy and people have to do other things. I would tell you, if you haven't served on this committee before, and I think Representative Davids would agree with me, this is kind of the best stuff of the whole year to really understand taxes, and it's the stuff you can hear every year and still be somewhat lost. Yes. So this, to me, is the absolute best stuff we get all year, and I hope you can ask a lot of questions, and we can just jump in, and I'm just going to hand it over to Mr. Michael to tell us who's up first.
Madam Chair, I believe that Cynthia Templin and Nina Manzi are going to go first in terms of going over state revenues and individual income tax.
Welcome. And I really mean, I hope members who've been on the committee a long time will ask all the questions you want, because these really are the experts on taxes. So who's going to start? Ms. Templin.
Madam Chair, before you have the PowerPoint presentation of state taxes, and there's a series of 70 slides, and I'm just going to go over the first slide here. It is just a high-level overview of state tax revenues. Just to start out, this slide shows general fund and non-general fund tax revenues based on the 2012 November forecast. The total state tax revenues in fiscal 13 were $19.69 billion. And as you can see from the slide, the biggest share comes from individual income tax at 43%. That equals $8.5 billion of the total. And sales tax at 30% equals $5.9 billion. And all other taxes equal about $5.1 billion. The biggest share of the all other tax total is corporate tax at $1 billion and motor vehicle fuels. And also the state property tax comes in with a really big share of the all other total at $817 million. So, and then Ms. Manzi will be going over the majority of the individual income tax section.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Nina Manzi from the House Research Department. I'd just like to take a minute. I think most of you have probably found the Word document that's also in your folders today. The Word document follows along in the same general order as the PowerPoint, but provides a lot more detail. So, for example, the underlying numbers for the other state taxes are there in a little table on page 2 at the top. So, both are good resources. All right, the individual income tax is the largest single source of state revenue. It's collected through withholding, so if you are in a job where you get a paycheck, the income tax is withheld from your pay each time you get paid. Estimated payments for people who don't have withholding through either, through either wages or through pensions, because you can have withholding on a pension, or you can also have withholding on distributions from retirement accounts. And then final payments, which is the part we're all the most familiar with, and that's when we have to write a check to the federal government or the state government on April 15th when we filed our final return. Tax returns are filed by April 15th. That's the filing date following the close of the tax year. So tax year 2012 returns and final payments are due by April 15th of 2013. And this ties back to what we talked about yesterday with House File 6, where people will begin filing their tax year 12 returns soon when filing opens at the end of this month. And then April 15th is the deadline to file by. You can file for an extension and get an extension until August 15th. Individual income tax revenue is projected to be $8.5 billion for fiscal 13. As Cynthia said, it's about 43% of state tax revenue. All individual income tax revenue goes to the general fund. This year, I want to point out that our previous reciprocity agreement with Wisconsin is not in effect, so there are not any reciprocity payments coming from Wisconsin to Minnesota. Instead, Wisconsin residents who work in Minnesota are filing Minnesota income tax returns and paying their Minnesota income tax liability that way. This line graph shows the changes in individual income tax revenue over the last 10 years. The top line is in 2013 dollars adjusted for inflation. So this graph really visually shows sort of the peak of the economic cycle there in 2008, followed by the dip, and then we started to have a recovery back toward the 2008 level, but we haven't quite reached that top point there at the peak on the dashed line.
Madam Chair, the next two slides have to do with tax incidents, and I will cover these slides. We will have tax incident slides for income tax and the other state taxes. And the data for these tax incident slides comes from the tax incidents report. It is a report that is statutorily required every 2 years, with the next report coming March 2013, so in a few months. This study analyzes the tax incidents across income groups for state and local taxes. Starting with the next report, federal taxes will be added to the mix, and that was a law change from last session.
Yes, Representative Garofalo, I think that was your bill, right? Yes. Yes. Did you have a question, Representative Loon? I see you. Were you raised? No. I thought I saw somebody. Sorry. That was just me. Yes, please.
This slide shows the effective income tax rate, and that is the ratio of taxes paid to household income, and the study looks at 2011. This slide shows for income tax that as income grows, the effective tax rate rises. This pattern shows or suggests how the state income tax system is more progressive. Oh, and I should also add a little bit more detail about the study. Going back to the effective tax rate, it is the information is presented in quintiles, and the tax incidence report shows the information in deciles. It's the same information, but for this presentation, we just kind of mushed it together. So, and also the first quintile shows the group with the lowest income, and the fifth quintile shows the group with the highest income.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you put some income numbers on those, like the fifth quintile? Starts where?
Madam Chair, Representative Benson. The first quintile starts with it's $16,278 and under, and the fifth quintile is $89,937 and over.
To interrupt, on page 5 of the longer handout, everyone can see all the income groups on all the quintiles. Ms. Templin.
Moving on to the next slide, this shows the percent of income taxes paid. This is this slide shows the total taxes paid by quintile in 2011. Since the income tax is progressive, the first quintile paid the first quintile shows at the smallest share of total income taxes paid. The fifth quintile shows the largest share of total income taxes paid. So as an example, that in the fifth quintile, that group paid $5.1 billion in income taxes out of a total of about $7 billion in income taxes paid. Just to put some numbers to that.
So. Representative Lesh.
Thank you. So I'm sorry, this may have already been answered, but is this single and joint filers, and is it adjusted gross income? How is it measured?
Ms. Templin.
It's all state income taxes paid, so it's federal taxable income with the Minnesota subtractions and additions.
Okay.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So
I'm sorry. It's household. This measures household income. I'm sorry, not personal income, but household income.
Okay. Thank you.
And the number on household income in the report is the total is $173 billion.
Okay, the Minnesota income tax, as we talked about a little bit yesterday with House File 6, Minnesota's income tax relies on the federal income tax. This makes it easier for taxpayers to comply with the state income tax and easier for the state to administer. We saw when we looked at House File 6 and saw the date reference to the Internal Revenue Code, how it incorporates federal law by reference. It incorporates the Internal Revenue Code by reference to a date. Since we rely on the federal law for a definition of taxable income, that allows us to have them share with us all of their compliance and enforcement efforts relating to the definition of taxable income. So if the IRS does an audit of someone and finds that there's a problem with their taxable income, they pass that information along to the state, and the state is able to benefit from that without having expended the resources to do the audit. Minnesota's individual income tax starts, as I said, with federal taxable income, which is income after federal deductions and exemptions. Minnesota then requires some things to be added to taxable income and allows some other things to be deducted from it. The income measure that we then arrive at is called Minnesota taxable income, and we apply our three income tax rates to that and then allow various credits against the tax liability that results. I used a couple of terms there, deductions and credits. A deduction is a subtraction from taxable income. So, for example, the mortgage interest deduction is an amount where you get to deduct the mortgage interest you pay from your taxable income. It reduces the amount of income that's subject to tax. A credit, in contrast, is a subtraction from tax. So after you go through and you apply the tax rates to your taxable income, you get your initial tax liability, and then you get to subtract whatever credit that you qualify for. For example, if you're a low-income working person, you might qualify for the working family credit. If you have dependent care expenses, you might qualify for the dependent care credit. If you're an angel investor, you might qualify for the angel investment credit. You get to subtract the credit that you qualify for from your tax that's due. For 2013, Minnesota has some additions to taxable income. We require the addition of interest on other states' bonds. The federal government does not tax interest on state bonds from any state. Minnesota doesn't tax interest on Minnesota state and local government bonds, but we do tax the interest on bonds from other states. So that amount gets added to our taxable income. We also have an addition for fines, fees, and penalties. And those are penalties that are assessed by a non-governmental board such as the Securities Exchange Commission. And we have an addition that helps, that addresses the fact that we did not go along with the federal government's carryback, more generous carryback allowances for net operating losses. So we have both additions and subtractions related to net operating losses to make up for the fact that we did not conform to the way the federal government started treating those a couple years ago. Some other things that we may or may not have additions for in tax year 2013. Now, yesterday when we talked about House File 6, it was just tax year 12 conformity, but the American Taxpayers Relief Act, enacted a few weeks ago, also made a lot of changes to the federal tax for tax year 13. So these are things that you'll probably all be talking about later in the session. Things that were extended for tax year 13 at the federal level were the additional standard deduction amount for married filers. The tuition expense deduction was extended both to 2012 and 2013, as was the educator classroom expense deduction. So House File 6 addresses the tuition and the educators for tax year 12. You'll still have on the table whether we want to conform to those for tax year 13. Also, the additional standard deduction for married filers, which is sometimes referred to as marriage penalty relief at the federal level. This provision makes the standard deduction for married couples filing jointly twice the size of the deduction allowed for single filers. Currently, Minnesota requires taxpayers to add the difference between the old standard deduction amount and the new standard deduction amount. So the legislature will have before it whether they want to retain that addition for tax year 13 or whether they want to conform, whether you all want to conform to the federal extension of that additional standard deduction amount. Other things that the federal government has put on the table for us in tax year 13 with the American Taxpayers Relief Act is the phase out of personal independent exemptions, the limitation of itemized deductions, increased bonus depreciation, and increased Section 179 expensing. The phase out of exemptions and the limitation of deductions is sort of an odd situation where for the last 2 years the state has required people at the state level to follow what was the old phase out and the old limitation in effect at the federal level prior to 2001. The federal government had extended the elimination of those two items, but we had additions for them in the last two tax years. Now what the federal government has done is put in place a new schedule, a new new income threshold for the phase-out, and the same income threshold for the limitation. So going forward where we are right now, we have a different phase-out and a different limitation than what the federal government has, which, as you can imagine, will be a little bit complicated for taxpayers to go along with because they'll have to, at the state level, first undo their federal limitation and then redo their state limitation. So that will be a subject for discussion when we get to tax year 13 conformity. The federal government also extended bonus depreciation and increased Section 179 expensing amounts. Since 2003 for the bonus depreciation, and I think since 2006 for the Section 179 expensing, Minnesota has not conformed to the increased federal amounts, but instead has required taxpayers to add back 80% of the difference between the old federal amount and the new federal amount, and then allowed a subtraction in the five following years for one-fifth of the amount added back. That's another thing that will be before you, is whether you want to continue the 80% add back for these items or whether you want to decide to conform to them. Conforming to them carries a rather large cost in the first fiscal year, and then because it's a shifting of the recognition of expensing from future years into the present. That's the benefit to businesses of these two provisions.
Excuse me, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Mansi, just before you get too much further, I just want to make sure I understand about this, the so-called marriage penalty, because that's something that people tend to ask about. Mm-hmm. And so if I'm understanding that the most recent federal tax bill, they got rid of the marriage penalty, right? And then Well, let me see how much of this I get right. Mm-hmm. And then in the couple of bills that are before the committee right now, we are for 2012, those bills are only for the 2012 tax year, and we are not changing our marriage penalty in those bills at all. But then going forward, we have a decision to make whether to go with the feds on eliminating this, and I assume it costs a lot of money to do that, which is why neither we nor the feds have done it before. Am I right on some of those things?
Ms. Manzi.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, the marriage penalty that's being addressed here is the marriage penalty that's present in the standard deduction for filers. So the federal government began eliminating the marriage penalty and the standard deduction in the 2001 tax bill, and then they accelerated that over time until the standard deduction for a married joint couple was exactly two times what it is for a single filer. Minnesota conformed to that, I think, through 2008. And the thing about it at the federal level was that it then expired after 2010, and at that point they extended it for two more years. So I'm sorry, I think we conformed with it through 2010, and then it was extended for two more years to 11 and 12. And there is a cost associated with it, because when you allow people a greater deduction, their taxable income becomes smaller. And so the tax revenue, the tax that they pay to the state or the federal government is smaller. They have now made that provision permanent in the American Taxpayers Relief Act. So for 2013, the legislature can choose to either retain the addition that's in our statute right now, or to strike that addition and go along with the federal standard deduction amount. The cost of that shows up in the revenue estimate that had more pages in it that you had in your folders yesterday. You had the sort of short revenue estimate for House File 6, which only listed the tax year 2012 provisions in the federal bill. And then there was a much longer revenue estimate that listed all of the provisions. And I believe that it's around, and Ms. Templin maybe can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the revenue impact of that would be around $73 million in fiscal year 13. If we were to conform to it. So now that I'm at the end, I'm not sure if I addressed all your questions.
Representative Liebling.
This is one of those topics where I'm kind of not sure what I don't know. And you must have a publication, or where should I look for the simple answer that I can give to constituents who ask me about this? I'm sure that others want that too.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, we don't have a publication specifically about the marriage penalty in the standard deduction. I can certainly write a memo for you on that. Maybe what I'll do is I'll write a memo to interested persons so that I can share it with you and others. We do have a publication that's somewhat related about marriage penalties in general. This is not the only marriage penalty in the income tax. And Mr. Michael and I wrote an information brief several years ago that describes several of the marriage penalties that are in the federal and state income tax. So that may be useful as a starting point.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I think that would be helpful, and I can only imagine, if you were to write up a little memo like that, I can only imagine that other members would want to see it as well. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, carrying on. Now we get to the subtractions, which are a little more fun at the legislative level, because these are things that let people reduce their taxable income and therefore reduce their tax liability. There are several Minnesota subtractions that are required by federal law. There are some types of income that the federal government prohibits the states from taxing. These include U.S. bond interest, railroad retirement benefits, and on-reservation earnings of members of Indian tribes. Then there are some subtractions that are required by the fact that we've deviated from the definition of federal taxable income. and these are tied back to the additions I talked about earlier. So with Section 179 expensing, bonus depreciation, and net operating losses, we have an addition in one tax year to reflect the fact that we have not agreed with the federal decision to accelerate those deductions into the present from the future. And when we do that, then we have to allow people to subtract the amounts that they aren't claiming at the federal level in future years. So you can see it takes a while to unwind the fact when you don't conform to what the federal government does in one year. Then we have deductions that the legislature has chosen to provide. These are for K-12 education expenses, charitable contributions by non-itemizers. People who itemize at the federal level can deduct their charitable contributions. Minnesota also allows people who don't itemize at the federal level but who take the standard deduction to deduct 50% of their contributions in excess of $500. We have a subtraction for low-income elderly filers. This is claimed by very few people. It primarily is allowed to for people who are not eligible for Social Security, so the pool of eligible people gets smaller and smaller each year. It ties back to when there were groups of people who hadn't been covered by Social Security. We have subtractions for active service military pay, so most kinds of military pay is allowed to be deducted at the state level. We have subtraction for Job Z income, for the expenses of organ donors, and then we have a few other minor subtractions.
Representative Lesh.
Ms. Manzi, on my Army W-2, whenever I get it for the active duty portions that I serve, there is zero. I don't think I recall there seeing anything on the state. So that's already taken into consideration for the W-2s done by the individual state. So what separate impact does it have for filing? Obviously, you're not double-dipping and counting it twice. But what are the implications for that on filling out the Minnesota form?
Ms. Manzi.
Representative Lincheski, Representative Lesh, the number that's zero on your W-2 from the Army is going to be the box for state income taxes withheld. The number that shows your wages is going to have a not zero number in it. Now, I guess I'll keep you as the example. You have other income as a Minnesota resident. You have your income as a Minnesota state legislator. So you are required to file a Minnesota state income tax return. And on that return, you start with your federal taxable income, which included your wages for your work in the Army in it. Then when you get to your state return, there's a line on Form M1M that allows you to subtract the amount of your wages that show up on your W-2 from the Army from your state taxable income. Otherwise, when you went through and applied the tax rates to your taxable income, your Army income would be in there, and you would be calculating your tax on it, although it's exempt. And the fact that it's exempt, you know, the Army recognizes and having adjusted your withholding. Now, if you were in active service and you were a Minnesota resident, but you spent your entire year outside of the state and you had no Minnesota income otherwise, then you wouldn't have a filing requirement for that year. Since you have other Minnesota source income, and many people in the military may have a spouse who lives in Minnesota who has a civilian job and other income. So a lot of people who qualify for that exemption and who have the zero on their W-2 still have to file a Minnesota return, but it's important to then go through and subtract your military pay on the M1M.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, the K-12 education deduction is one that I'm going to talk a little bit more about. This is sort of ties together with the credit, which we'll get to a little later. There's no income limit on eligibility for the K-12 education deduction. The maximum deduction is $2,500 for students in grades 7 through 12, $1,625 for students in grades K through 6. There are a lot of different expenses eligible for this credit, including non-public school, I'm sorry, for this deduction, including non-public school tuition. Non-public school tuition does not qualify for the credit. everything else of the expenses are the same for the credit and the deduction, and they include things like after-school tutoring expenses, enrichment classes, transportation expenses that you pay to others, amounts that you pay for textbooks, musical instruments. There's a big list of them. Okay, then you get to your state taxable income, and these are the rates that are in effect for tax year 2013. These are the rates that have been in effect since 2000. 5.35%, 7.05%, and 7.85%. And over on the left, it shows the income brackets for a married couple filing jointly for this tax year. The way the brackets work is that you pay 5.35% of your first $35,480 of taxable income. Then you pay 7.05% of income that's over the $35,480 and up to $149.60. So if you're in that second bracket, it doesn't mean that you pay 7.05% on all of your income. It just means that you pay 7.05% on the part over the $35,480. That's the way the graduated income tax works. And this graduated rate structure is part of how we get to the graph that Ms. Templin showed you, where there's a higher effective tax rate for higher income filers than for lower income filers. Because the higher your income goes, the more of it is being taxed at the higher rates. And these brackets, I should point out, are indexed each year for inflation. Now we get to the credits, which apply to your tax. So you apply the tax rates to your income and you get your tax, and then you're going to maybe be eligible for some credits. There are basically two flavors of credits. There is the non-refundable credit and the refundable credit. A non-refundable credit can be used to offset liability, but if your credit that you're eligible for is bigger than your liability, you simply forfeit the extra part of your credit. A refundable credit is one that can be used to offset liability, and if you have any credit left over in excess of your liability, then the state pays that to you as a check. It gets paid as part of your refund check. So the refundable credits are sort of the tax world's equivalent of transfer programs. They can be used to provide benefits to lower income taxpayers. The major non-refundable credits is a credit for taxes paid to other states. In this way, the various states that have income taxes will have a credit like this, and it's designed to keep people from paying tax twice on the same income. It doesn't exactly work that way, but that's the intent of it, and that's the purpose of it. We have a marriage credit, and this is what I alluded to earlier in response to Representative Liebling's question. In 1999, the Minnesota legislature wanted to try to reduce the marriage penalties, not in the standard deduction, but rather in our rate and bracket system. And the one way to do that is to provide brackets for married filers that are twice the size of those allowed for single filers. That has the effect not only of eliminating marriage penalties, but also of providing marriage bonuses to couples in which one spouse has all the income and the other spouse doesn't have any income. So we, as is often the case, there were limited resources available to the legislature, and staff was tasked with coming up with an alternative to simply doubling the brackets, which at the time had a revenue impact of about $100 million a year. So we worked to come up with a credit in which there is a calculation so that couples in which both spouses have earnings get a credit in order to offset the additional tax they pay because they both have earnings. And now there's a table in the income tax booklet that you look up. It goes off of the combined income of the two spouses and then the earnings of the lesser earning spouse and offsets the marriage penalty. And they simply call it the marriage credit. And there'll be a separate form for it starting this year. And that credit is what there's a publication about available from our office. There's also a credit for long-term care insurance and a credit for military service of individuals who retired either with a disability or with 20 or more years of service. Okay, the credit for taxes paid to other states is, and this is why it doesn't always end up working out quite right, but taxpayers calculate tax on all their income, including the amount earned in other states, and then you can get a credit against our tax equal to the tax paid on to the other state. The total amount in 2010 is $156.2 million. Marriage penalty credit, which I just talked about without the benefit of looking at the slide, is based on the earnings of each spouse and the combined taxable income. It's intended to offset the penalty in our rate and bracket structure as it relates to earned income of both spouses. The maximum credit in tax year 12 is $361, and this credit has grown from about $50 million from when it was enacted to being about $64.5 million in fiscal 13. The long-term care credit equals 25% of premiums paid for long-term care insurance. That's premiums that aren't claimed as a medical expense deduction at the federal level. The maximum credit is $100 per beneficiary, so $200 for a married couple in which each spouse has coverage. There are about 60,000 people claiming this credit in tax year 2010, and it's projected to have a revenue impact of about $8.4 million in fiscal 2013. The credit for past military service is allowed for retirees who either had 20 years of service or separated from the military with a disability. The maximum credit allowed is $750, and it's phased out for those with income over $30,000. It's fully phased out when income reaches $37,500. There are about 1,600 claimants in tax year 10, and the revenue impact is about $1 million. This credit has been pretty consistent in the 3 years it's been in effect at about that 1,600 claimants and about $1 million per year. Now we get to the refundable credits. We have the working family credit, which is sort of parallels the federal earned income credit, K-12 education credit for K-12 education expenses, and the dependent care credit for dependent care expenses. Also, we have a credit. It's in the income tax chapter, but it's really sort of administered as a direct payment by the Department of Revenue to members of the military who've served in combat zones. I think I'll have a slide for that later on. Then there's a few more refundable credits. There's a credit for Job Z income. Then there are three credits that were enacted as part of the Jobs Bill in 2010, the Angel Investment Credit, the Historic Structure Rehabilitation Credit, and the Research Credit for Individuals. The Working Family Credit equals a percentage of earnings. So this is a credit that you only get if you have earnings, if you have either wage or self-employment income. It phases out as income increases, so it's directed toward lower income filers. The maximum income eligible for a family with two or more children in 2013 is almost $43,000. About 344,000 claimants are going to claim this credit in 2011. The average credit is about $600. And this credit is projected to have a revenue impact of just over $200 million in fiscal year 13. So this is a pretty large program. One of the reasons to administer a program directed toward lower income working people through the income tax system is that it's a fairly efficient way to administer these transfers, because people who have a job and have earnings are going to be filing an income tax return anyway. So they claim their credit as part of their income tax return rather than having to make an application to the county or the state through a different agency in order to get a transfer payment. The K-12 education credit equals 75% of eligible expenses. There's a maximum credit of $1,000 per child with no limit on the number of children for whom you can claim the credit. It has an income-based phase-out that starts at $33,500. The phase-out, how far the phase-out runs depends on how many children you're claiming the credit for. you're claiming it for one or two children, it fully phases out when your income reaches $37,500, and then the maximum income increases by another $2,000 for each additional child for whom you claim the credit. So it goes up to $39,500 for three children, $41,500 for four children, and so on. And it does that so that the credit doesn't have in its structure a sort of sharp cliff where all of a sudden, you know, at one income level, you're eligible for a $500 credit, and then if you make a dollar more of income, you lose your credit entirely. So it the income extends so it can be feathered out gradually across the phase-out range. About 57,000 people claimed this credit in 2010. The average was just under $300. The revenue impact in fiscal 13 is projected to be $14.4 million. The dependent care credit is tied to the federal dependent care credit. It's based on actual amounts paid for child care. The maximum credit is $1,440 for a care of two or more children. It's $720 for a care of one child. It phases out as income increases, and the income threshold used for it is adjusted each year for inflation. In tax year 13, this credit will be allowed for incomes up to almost $40,000. About 36,500 people claim this credit in 2011. The average credit is $400, and it's estimated at $14.6 million of revenue impact in fiscal 13. The military service credit,
Madam Chair,
this is administered separately
Excuse
from the income
me.
Tax.
Pardon me.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Manzi, on the dependent care credit, does that apply to after-school child care that's provided, or is it just, are we talking from birth to school age?
Ms. Manzi.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, I think it applies up through age 13, and it does include after-school care. The amount that you pay for child care that you can claim for the credit is limited to the amount of earnings that you have, so it's the underlying rationale for the credit was that it was to recognize the expenses that parents had for providing for care of their children in order for the parents to be in the workforce. So if you don't have any earnings, then you're not eligible for the credit. But if, as long as you have earnings, you can take it for after-school care or for full day daycare.
Representative Anderson, further? No. Thank
Madam
you.
Chair?
Yes, Representative Earhart.
Yes. Madam Chair, I'd like to ask about the K-12 education credit. That seems like a small amount. Is that because a lot of people don't know about this or because the incomes are too high to qualify?
Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, is it the $270 average credit that seems like a small amount?
The number.
The
57,000 claimants.
Oh, the number of people who claim it. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, the reason there are, excuse me, relatively few people who claim it, I would say, is based on the, I think people probably know about it. It would be more based on the income level phase out that's in there. It's targeted to relatively low-income people, and in order to get the credit, you have to incur the expenses during the tax year, and then you claim the credit when you file your return. So, for example, somebody whose child started school last September would maybe have expenses for books, paper, pencils, those sorts of things all would qualify. And they would, you know, save their receipts and however much that they paid for it. And then when they file their income tax return this year, the credit would be for 75% of those amounts, provided they were in the eligible income range. Now, obviously, the income range is such that there are going to be some households that aren't going to, it's not going to be within their budget to get up to the full $1,000 per child expenses for perhaps after-school enrichment programs or an academic summer camp or something like that. So the average credit of $270 is reflecting actual expenses of something just under $400
per child. So that
thank
you're
you.
Nodding, yep. So I hope that answers and addresses your question.
Thank you.
Okay, back to the military service credit, which the Department of Revenue administers separately from the income tax. This credit equals $120 for each month or portion of a month that an individual serves in a combat zone. There are about 2,500 people who claim this credit each year. The average credit they get is about $760. The total is projected at $1.9 million in fiscal 13. The way this works is once the year is up or you've transferred out of the combat zone, then you file your the requested military paperwork with the Department of Revenue on a separate form from the income tax return at any time of the year, and then you will get this credit. So this is almost sort of like a bonus that's administered on an ongoing basis through the Department of Revenue. The Job Z credit is a refundable credit for businesses that increase employment in a Job Z zone. It's a 7% rate to wages paid to an employee that are in excess of $36,510, but not over $121,710, and those are the amounts in effect for tax year 12 and are indexed annually for inflation. The way the credit is calculated, it prevents payment of the credit to the employer if their overall Minnesota employment goes down over the course of the tax year. The Angel Investment Credit equals 25% of investment in small businesses. The maximum credit is $125,000. Business must be located in Minnesota and must be certified by deed as meeting the requirements of the Angel Investment Credit law, which means they have to be engaged in specified fields of work. The credit has got a fixed amount appropriation per year, so the way deed administers it is that people apply for a credit and then they say, I'm going to make an investment in this business that you've certified as being eligible. And then deed will look and see if it has money available in its pool for the year, and if it does, then that person gets an allocation, and then when they make the actual investment, then they get awarded a credit certificate. If they don't make the investment, then their allocation goes back into the pool for the next investor who comes in and applies for a credit. This credit is scheduled to sunset after tax year 2014. There's annual reporting on this credit from deed to the legislature, and each year that it's been in effect, the maximum allocation has been used up, except for the first year when it took deed a while to get the program up and running, and that allocation was allowed to shift into the next year, and then that cumulative amount was fully used up. The Historic Structure Rehabilitation Credit or Grant, this is one where taxpayers have the option of choosing to take this amount as a grant rather than a credit. This provides a match to the Federal Historic Credit, which is 20% of rehabilitation expenses. It applies to rehabilitating a certified historic structure that's an income-producing property. The credit gets claimed after the property is placed back in service. This credit does not have a limit on how much can be claimed per year, like the Angel Investment Credit. The amount claimed under this credit in fiscal 2013 was almost $30 million. So far, it's only been claimed by corporate filers. It could be claimed by individuals who own a structure or individuals who own a structure as part of an S corporation or a partnership, but to date it's just been claimed by corporations. This credit sunsets after fiscal 2015.
Madam Chair.
Representative Earhart.
Ms. Nancy, is that a certified historic structure is certified by who? The state, the federal?
Ms. Nancy.
Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, that would be certified by the U.S. Department of the Interior, as it would be a structure that's on the National Register of Historic Places, or it's in a neighborhood that's certified also by, I think it's the Department of Interior that does this as a historic district.
Representative Earhart? Further. Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, Ms. Manzi, does Representative Earhart qualify as a historic structure? Or I know the answer to the question. That's
okay, moving on to the research credit. This credit has been in existence under the corporate tax for quite a long time. It was extended to the individual tax for S corporations, partnerships, and LLCs in the 2010 jobs bill. It's based on a similar federal credit, and it equals 10% of the first $2 million of research-related expenditures, and then 2.5% of research-related expenditures over $2 million. The revenue impact in fiscal 13 is estimated at $8 million, and that's the individual portion only. Mr. Michael will discuss the corporate portion when we get to the corporate franchise tax part of the presentation. Okay, there's a credit that's in existence that no one is claiming right now, and that's the bovine tuberculosis testing credit, and that's because Minnesota was declared to be free of bovine TB in 2011. If there's a recurrence of bovine tuberculosis in the state, then the credit would come back into effect. It would equal 50% of testing costs for non-corporate cattle owners and 25% for corporate cattle owners. It's only allowed when federal bovine TB testing is required. Okay, now we've come to the end of the individual income tax portion of the presentation. Representative Lincheski asked us to include in this presentation a little discussion of tax policy principles and of reform options that have been discussed for the various taxes, and that's going to come up at the end of each tax section.
And Ms. Manzi, I'm going to interrupt. Just I forgot about it. So I just want to tell members, when I had asked nonpartisan tax staff to do this, I have not seen this presentation we're seeing today. I'm watching it live like all of you. I knew that there was a lot of talk about tax reform, and I knew that the governor was talking about it. So I asked then, and I kind of forgot about it till right now, I think it was in December, that when we normally do these orientations that, you know, Representative Davids did this, and we've all kind of done this in the beginning of taxes, to throw in sort of a broader economic policy kind of concept of what you could reform in all the major taxes or how you would want to think about it. So it's really silent on what any partisan side might think about it. And I just want to reassure everybody, had nothing to do with creating it. There's no agenda here. It's just to think about it. And I think now that I'm hearing, you know, we're going to see it, it's going to be timely since we all are waiting to see what the governor will do on Tuesday. So maybe this will frame some of it, depending on what he does. So thank you.
You're welcome, Madam Chair. Okay, since the income tax is first, then I get to provide the overview of these principles. There are four generally agreed on principles for tax policy, and these are pretty much shared by economists and tax researchers across the country. Sometimes people use a little bit different names for them, but these are the main four principles. Adequacy means that a tax system should provide sufficient revenue for the government. And sort of a sub-point under this is that you probably don't necessarily want to have your tax system rely on one tax, and you in particular don't want to have a lot of reliance on a volatile tax in your tax system, because you want to have a predictable and sufficient source of revenue for the spending programs that the government's going to embark on. Administration and compliance means that the tax system should have a minimal compliance cost to the taxpayer, and it should have a minimal administrative cost to the government for collecting the tax. The amount of time that the taxpayer has to spend complying with the tax and the amount of time that the agency has to spend administering the tax. Well, the amount of time that the taxpayer has to spend complying is sort of what's called a deadweight loss to the economy, because they're not being productive, they're not engaging in leisure pursuits that they might find enjoyable. They're simply taking time away from their life to comply with the tax. So an ideal tax system would minimize the amount of time that it takes for the taxpayer to comply with it.
As for administration, the more costly it is for the government to administer the tax, then the more revenue has to be collected through the tax system in order to pay for the government to administer it. So it's desirable to minimize the cost to the government of administering the tax. Efficiency. This principle holds that a tax should interfere as little as possible with the economy. The idea is that the government shouldn't be using the tax system to pick winners and losers, to encourage, you know, perhaps encourage one type of consumption over another type of consumption. Now, as we saw when we talked about the deductions and credits, well, the government does use the tax systems to sort of pick winners and losers. We've said that, you know, we prefer people to spend money on rehabilitating historic structures rather than to spend money on tearing them down, because we're going to provide a credit for the cost of rehabilitating them. So the government does use the tax system to engage in social policy, furthering social goals through all of those credits and deductions. Equity has two components to it. Vertical equity holds that the tax burden imposed on an individual or household should reflect their ability to pay. So you shouldn't really be imposing an extremely large tax on a household with a low income when they simply don't have the ability to pay for that and to maintain any kind of standard of living. Horizontal equity holds that individuals who are similarly situated should pay similar taxes. So you shouldn't have people who have similar incomes paying different levels of tax. Now, of course, tax systems, see, when I get to the next slide, you'll see that tax systems, there's a lot of trade-offs between all of these principles. Sometimes you give something up on one and you take something back on another. A way in which the federal income tax, for example, isn't equitable in a horizontal way is that someone who has all of their income from dividends is taxed at a lower federal rate than someone who has all of their income from wages, because there's a preferential rate for dividends. So an economist or tax policy professor looking at that tax would say that it doesn't score well on horizontal equity in that component. No tax is a perfect tax. I've already pointed out some ways where the income tax deviates from those principles. And you could devise a lot of hypothetical taxes. You could come up with some that might be very efficient, that might not cause any distortion in markets, but they might not be very fair. You could come up with others that would be very fair, but they might be very hard to administer. So what the lot of the policymaker is to engage in trade-offs between those principles. Those principles are things that you should just keep in mind as you're considering changes to the tax system. And you have to, you know, weigh the strengths and weaknesses of the various taxes in the mix. Generally, you know, looking at the adequacy principle, you probably don't want to have just one tax. You want to have several taxes, and those taxes are going to have different strengths and weaknesses as far as efficiency, the ability to administer them, and whether or not they're considered to be equitable either vertically or horizontally. So it's my first try ever at that. Does anybody have any questions about those principles? Okay. Now we'll move on. There'll be a slide at the end of each section that simply lays out some of the reform options that have been proposed either federally or at the state level recently for the various taxes. With regard to the income tax, one option that people always bring up is to expand the base, get rid of deductions, get rid of credits, and that would allow you to then reduce the rate that's imposed and collect the same amount of revenue. Another way to simplify the tax would be to conform more closely to the federal law, to do what they do on Section 179 expensing rather than have our add back and subtraction scheme. Another way to reform and simplify the income tax would be to consolidate the various low income credits that we have. You saw I went through several of them on the slides. There have been proposals off and on over the last 20 years to put those together into a single unifying credit. sometimes people also talk about combining them with the homeowner or the renter property tax refund. Another reform option that's discussed is replacing credits that are targeted directly at certain activities with direct appropriations. And that's something where there's something of an experiment going on at the state level with the historic structure credit, which is allowed to be claimed either as a credit or a grant. And there's a report due on that from, I don't know if it's from the Historic Society or if they have to contract with somebody to do it, but there we'll get more information about how much was claimed as a credit and as a grant and the strengths and weaknesses of that. And that's time for Pat, and she's right there. Okay, so that's going to be the end of the individual income tax. Unless anyone has any questions, I'm going to move away from the table.
Thank you so much. And I think all members know Ms. Manzi is a great educator, and find your way up to her office on the sixth floor if you want to understand something better. She's really wonderful for all of us and helping us look like we understand what we don't. So thank you. Appreciate it.
Madam Chair, as Ms. Dalton gets settled, I'll just cover the first couple slides for sales tax. Looking at slide 39, sales tax revenue at $6 billion projected for fiscal 13. Of that, and $565 million is projected for the motor vehicle sales tax. Sales tax are about a third of total state tax revenues, and according to the tax incidence report, about businesses pay about 44% of the tax. Moving to the next slide, you will see a 10-year horizon of sales tax revenues from fiscal 2003 to fiscal 2013. Tax revenues are shown in actual dollars and adjusted for inflation. You can see that in fiscal 13, in actual dollars, sales tax revenues were in the range of 4.8, almost $5 billion, and in 2013, the projection is $5.9 billion. Kind of in contrast to the income tax revenues, the 10-year horizon for income taxes, sales tax appears to not fluctuate as much as income tax. It doesn't mimic the economy as much. You don't see the same dips. They're not as pronounced that you saw in the income tax revenue 10-year horizon. So moving on.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Anderson.
Ms. Templin, can you tell me how much does government pay in sales tax?
Madam Chair, the sales tax expenditure report shows the amount that is exempted for state agencies, but the we don't have what the state pays in sales taxes. I can't think of a report, but I can check on that and get back to you.
Thank you. Madam Chair,
Ms. Dalton,
I believe that in the tax incidence study where they separate out what's paid personally versus what's paid by business, I think the government payments are part of that business payment.
We can check on that. And Representative Anderson, I don't know if maybe you're asking, over the years I've noticed a lot of legislators bipartisanly ponder why should the local governments pay sales tax on things they purchase to the state, and will frequently make the double taxation argument. Is that what you're referencing?
Yeah.
You know,
I think it's helpful to know what is that, what chunk of the pie is it?
Yeah, and I thought I remembered, but I probably shouldn't even say it. I thought it was a kind of a $150 million per year, kind of $300 million biennia, but I'm probably wrong on that. I know Representative Liebling's had this bill, too, and Ms. Dalton, can you recall, it's been authored by Republicans and Democrats many times, and we've never found the money to pay for it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I do think it's somewhere between $100 and $150 million dollars a year to totally exempt local governments from it for everything except the things where they're actually in direct competition with the private sector.
So does everyone get the concept on that? You know, you buy a fire truck and you pay for taxes, and then, or you know, your city government buys something, and you in addition to the taxpayer buying it, the city pays tax to the state on top of it. So I think that's what Representative Anderson's talking about.
Yeah, and Madam Chair and members of the committee, it should also be pointed out that the state pays sales tax on their purchases as well. And
do we buy?
We have not had a bill on that, so we don't have a revenue estimate on how much the state pays. And that actually occurred before we imposed a sales tax on local governments. So it's been a long time that the state has actually paid it.
Well, thank you, Ms. Dalton. And, of course, the state buys things. Does the state buy anything from local units of government that you can think of? I know the locals kind of do. They're, you know, and I want to go to Representative Liebling, too, and but back to Representative Anderson. I don't want to open a whole thing here, but there is lore around here that people have been here a long time can tell you, and everyone's got a different story about, was there a trade-off for sales tax for local units of government if they, I don't know, didn't get their LGA cut or something like this? And maybe Ms. Dalton can just tell us just a smidge on that, because there's some history with what Representative Anderson is raising that relates to this whole massive plan in state funding of local units of government.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, that actually is correct. The year that sales tax was imposed on local governments, there was a kind of a gentleman's agreement that instead of cutting aids, I think there may still have been an aid cut that year, but it was a much smaller aid cut than they were originally planning, and it was a trade-off. One reason it was done this way is we had some cities and we had some local governments who were not getting aid, and so this was a way to share the pain between all local governments, regardless of whether they got LGA and county program aid or not.
Okay. Representative Anderson, anything further? No. Representative Liebling, and then Earhart. Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Not to drag this out too much, I was going to just say to members that when you get into these kind of things, sometimes it seems you look at something like this and you say, well, that's just absurd. And I know I did carry a bill at least once or twice several years ago to get rid of this, and then found out, A, that it costs a lot of money to get rid of it, but also that it's really complicated because of this. Whatever the original intention was, and I think Ms. Dalton laid it out pretty well, but when you get rid of a tax like this, you're getting winners and losers. So even now, even when we're not in that original agreement, it may not be an evenly distributed thing. And so I kind of hope that if we could do an overall tax reform, that some things like this could go away in the mix. But it's really tough when you pull this out and say, what a ridiculous tax this is, let's just get rid of it. Then you are opening a whole other can of worms.
Thank you. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In this, business pays about 44%. Aside from the government payments, is this the business-to-business tax, sales tax as well that we're talking about?
Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, that is correct. Businesses, we have a number of exemptions, which we'll talk about later for businesses, but we have a number of items that we still continue to make businesses pay sales tax on, even though they are inputs to what they eventually sell to their consumers. And we'll talk about that when we talk about the reform issues facing.
And Representative Earhart, for new members, we should add, too, that people will refer to this as pyramiding or taxing business inputs. And that 44% that you're referencing on all of the sales tax, of course, is a regressive tax. So I think business community is very interested in trying to reduce the sales taxes, because it's really hurting them. Well, Representative Earhart.
Madam Chair, the reason I ask that is because someone who's working on tax reform claims that it would be impossible to extract all the business-to-business payments if we were to broaden the sales tax. Would you venture a guess on that?
Ms. Dalton, is that you who claimed that?
No.
Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, it's not myself who claimed it, but there are some issues that would get somewhat sticky. Ideally, the sales tax should be a tax only on personal consumption. on final personal consumption, and it should not be on business inputs. But there are issues that get somewhat difficult when you try to differentiate between what is a sale to business and what is a sale for personal consumption, particularly when you are talking small businesses and sole proprietors. Uh-huh. If you want to tax legal services, and you have a sole proprietor who is going to do a will, is that a business expense as it relates to what happens to the disposal of the business or the continuation of the business after he dies, or is that a personal expense? So those are some of the issues that you get into that are, administrative issues that can get very difficult, as we try to move to a pure consumer sales tax and eliminate some of the business-to-business taxes.
Representative Earhart.
I think we should talk about this a little more, but not now. Thank you.
Ms. Dalton.
Actually, going to the next slide, we come again to the tax incident slides. Again, for sales tax, this slide shows the effective tax rates for sales tax, which is the ratio of sales taxes paid to household income. This slide shows the distribution of the tax by income group. Again, you can see the first quintile. It is 7.7%, and that is broken down by consumers and businesses. And unlike the individual income tax, unlike that slide for effective tax rates, this slide shows that the first quintile pays the highest share of the tax relative to household income. And this pattern also suggests that the sales tax is a regressive tax. Moving on, if there are no questions, we come to the percent of sales taxes paid. You can see, again, for the first quintile, that they pay the smallest share of total sales taxes. In this slide, the first quintile paid $367.8 million out of $4.2 billion. And that is it for the tax incident slides.
Madam Chair, are we supposed to be asking questions as we go?
Sure, absolutely.
To the effective sales tax rate, couldn't that be solved in that first quintile by some kind of credit?
Evelyn.
Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, that would offset the taxes paid, so that would reduce their effective tax rate.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stone. And Ms. Dalton, I think if you can do the next two slides and then we'll adjourn. That I think members are going to be very interested in the slide after the next two slides, and that whole discussion will open up that people are hearing a lot about and guessing about what the governor might do. And so I think maybe we can start with that one tomorrow. But if you want to do this one and the legacy, I think then we'll adjourn after that. Okay? Start with you on tomorrow.
Madam Chair, happy to do it that way. This slide basically talks about the distribution of sales tax revenues. As Ms. Templin said, there's about $6 billion in sales tax for fiscal year 2013. $565 million of that is motor vehicle sales tax. That amount is constitutionally dedicated revenues, and it has to go 40% to public transit and 60% to the Highway User Trust Fund. The next dedication is a tax on motor vehicle leases. This is not a constitutional dedication. This is a statutory dedication, but it is somewhat based on mirroring what happened with the motor vehicle sales tax. All but $32 million of the motor vehicle leases goes to fund Greater Minnesota Transit and the County State Aid Highway Fund. Now, the $32 million was originally kept in the general fund because it was supposed to fund a low-income motor fuels credit when the gas tax was raised. However, that tax, that credit was repealed, and the money essentially just stays in the general fund. So about 22.9 million out of the 55.9 million in fiscal year 2012 goes to the highway funds, and 32 million stays in the general fund. Lottery in lieu payments. The lottery, when you purchase a lottery ticket, you do not pay a sales tax, but the lottery pays an in lieu tax, essentially equivalent to the sales tax that would be owed on lottery tickets. This is an administrative issue, which is why it's done this way. 87% of that revenue is not going to the general fund. So only 13% goes to the general fund. 87% is going to other funds. It's distributed 50% to the heritage account, 22.5% to state parks and trails, 22.5% to metro parks and trails, 3% to local trails and grants, and 2% to the zoos, the Minnesota Zoo, Como, and the Duluth Zoo. Again, that is a statutory dedication rather than a constitutional dedication. And then the final dedication is the legacy dedication. And that is the legacy amendment raised the sales tax by from 6.5% by another additional 3.75%, giving us that lovely rate of 6.875%, which we all forget because it's such an odd number. That extra amount raises $275 million a year. It was went into effect July 1, 2009. It is in effect for 20 years. As I said, the money from this amount is constitutionally dedicated. And as you can see from the slide, it shows you where the revenues go to. This tax applies to sales that are taxable under the general sales tax, which means it applies to everything that's taxable under Chapter 297A. It means it doesn't apply to the motor vehicle sales tax, which is taxable under Chapter 297B. So motor vehicle sales tax stays at 6.5%. This causes kind of an interesting anomaly because if you lease a car, car leases are subject to the general sales tax, not the motor vehicle sales tax. So if you lease a car, you pay a sales tax of 6.875%. If you buy your car, you pay a lower rate of 6.5%. And one final comment, just because it is an issue that will come up as people start talking about base expansion and sales tax, the constitutional amendment does allow the legislature to adjust the rate, the legacy rate, if the base is changed. They don't have to, but they are allowed to.
Okay.
And at that point, we'll stop.
Thank you. Representative Davis.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair. Just a quick question on procedure for House File 6, and I think it's 63. Would we be taking a vote on that this week sometime, or what's your plan on that?
Well, my plan is to ask every member of this committee to call their senator and explain to them why taxpayers need early conformity. At this moment in time, the Senate is not ready to act on this very important piece of legislation, and I've expressed I'm disappointed about that, but we're hoping bipartisanly we can push them all along to help them get educated as to why federal conformity is so important. And so at this time, we're not going to vote today, and I don't think we'll vote tomorrow, but I'm going to keep working on it, and I hope you will too, Representative Davids.
Madam Chair, I certainly will.
Okay, thank
you. Very important to move that forward.
Thank you for asking. Okay, anything else? If not, we're adjourned. We'll see you tomorrow. I'm sorry. Representative Hansen.
Sorry about that, Madam Chair. On the slide that's there, I was wondering if staff could provide us maybe a handout on a breakdown between the 7-county metro area amount raised and the rest of the state on the 0.375 raised for the legacy amendment.
Okay, so we'll have that for next meeting. Thank you very much. We're adjourned.